This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Last summer, parts of Lake Champlain had large outbreaks of toxic blue-green algae blooms, which can cause health problems in humans and have been fatal to animals swimming in the lake. Officials closed multiple beaches because of them. Pat Kaversazi has had a home on St. Albans Bay for 40 years and had never seen the water on the front edge of her property so green before.
Even though they've seen blue-green algae and they've located a little bit down there, now it's spread incredibly, and it looks like a carpet. I mean, it's really, really bad.
In his inaugural address in January, Governor Peter Shumlin took aim at the pollution problem in Lake Champlain. He created the Clean Water Fund with state, federal, and private contributions. And the legislature took up the battle with the passing of House Bill 35 2 weeks ago. This morning, the Senate Natural Resources and Energy Committee met to discuss their version, Senate Bill 49. Today on Vermont Edition, we're going to learn a little bit more about what's actually included in these pieces of legislation and how the sponsors think new rules could help clean up Lake Champlain and other Vermont waterways. We're also going to talk about the major funding issues and whether or not the Federal Environmental Protection Agency is likely to get off the state's back with the passage of a new lake cleanup plan. Joining us fresh from work this morning in the Capitol Dome are Representative David Dean, chair of the House Committee on Fish, Wildlife, and Water Resources, and Senator Chris Bray, chair of the Senate Natural Resources and Energy Committee. They are both sponsors of their chamber's respective bills. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Representative Dean, let's start with you because the House bill has already passed the full House. What exactly are you trying to accomplish with House Bill 35?
We hope that it will offer technical assistance and support to our agriculture community, in addition to be able to work with municipalities to address stormwater runoff problems with their roads and other development within those communities. So it is a bill that stretches across all of the major sources of, in the case of Lake Champlain, nutrient loading into the lake, causing the blue-green algae that your interview just addressed. And it will strengthen the hand of both the Agency of Agriculture, Food and Markets and the Department of Environmental Conservation so that where it becomes necessary, they have the enforcement tools to be able to require compliance in order for the waters to meet the state water quality standards.
Are you happy with the bill as it passed?
Yes. We were engaged for about 2.5 months in this year. But this bill is a product of work that the Fish, Wildlife, and Water Resources Committee has been working on all the way back through last biennium and the biennium before that, with the passage of Act 110, then the passage of Act 138. And I don't know what the act number will be for this effort, but it will become part of an ongoing effort on the part of both the House and Senate to address water quality problems statewide.
You, Senator Bray, were discussing the Senate version S-49 this morning in your committee. We got a tweet from a listener who was hoping for good news, hoping to hear that it had passed out of your committee and been approved. Can you give her that good news?
Sure. So you can have breaking news. I almost ran from the State House here to the studio. Because we just voted out our version of our bill was S-49, and we just voted that out of committee. And the way this bill will proceed is it's next going to go to Finance and Appropriations and then to the Senate floor. But the way it will travel back to the House is that we did it as an amendment to H-35, and then that's our vehicle to get the bill back to the House, and we'll have a conversation in one way or another between the two bodies to come to a final bill. But what we sent back was actually we worked – I've been talking with Representative Dean since – well, before the session started, but almost daily since January. And our version of the bill As we've developed it, we've watched what they've been doing, and it's really an amalgam of what we thought were the best practices from both sides.
So can you talk a little bit, just so that we have a sense of where the daylight is between the two bills, or what is different in your now amendment from the House bill?
Sure. I think probably the thing that will get a lot of people's attention in the next few weeks, especially because the bill's now off to finance and to talk about how they're going to raise the money to pay for the program, and then in appropriations to line those monies up with the programs that we want to support, people will probably be talking about the money for the most part, I think. But in terms of the policy and programs underneath, there's a great deal of similarity. And I think it's there are small adjustments here and there, but for the most part, the two bills align very well at the policy level.
We're taking a look today at water quality and pollution plans for the state of Vermont. They are, as we've just heard, still tangled up in the legislature, but it looks like something is going to pass before the legislature breaks this spring. And we're finding out more about what's in the two bills on the table. Listeners, if you want to share your thoughts on what needs to be done to prevent pollution in Vermont's streams, rivers, and lakes, and what can be done to remediate pollution that's already there, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Senator Bray, you mentioned that a lot of people are going to be talking about money, so let's do the same. Let's talk about money and how much you're planning to raise in these bills and where it's going to come from. David Dean, can you talk a little bit first about how you plan to raise $8 million in the next fiscal year?
Our plan was based on fees in terms of the agriculture and environmental conservation staff capacity. So we were going to rely on fees paid by large farm operations, medium farm operations, small farm operations, a fee on non-agricultural fertilizer, and that money would be dedicated to the staff necessary to do the outreach, training, education with farmers on the ag side. In terms of the municipal side, we increased the amount of certain fees that the environmental conservation already has. And then because we are expanding the responsibilities for municipalities and others to deal with the stormwater runoff of roads, there are, in fact, new permits, and the fees paid to obtain those new permits will fuel the capacity building at environmental conservation. In terms of – we created a Clean Water Trust Fund. And in terms of putting monies into that trust fund, which would be granted back to agricultural practitioners, the municipalities, and others to do on-the-ground projects to reduce pollution loading, that money would come from an increase in the property transfer tax of 0.2%. That will give us somewhere in the neighborhood of $6 million, and the two fee increases that I spoke about just this minute will give us an additional $2
million. And so that'll be about $8
million. Yeah, that's about the $8 million that was envisioned on in our bill as it passed the House.
Senator Bray, is that similar to what you're passing?
We've taken a little different approach. We are one of the sayings about this bill from the very beginning, which has been part of its strength, is that we've been saying everybody's in, meaning that sometimes in the past when we've tried to work on water quality issues, one sector ends up pointing fingers at another sector. So people say, well, it's really wastewater treatment plants that's the big problem, or it's really farms that's really the big problem, or it's runoff from large developments. And we're saying, you know, the waters of the state are everywhere, and so it's everybody's concern to be focused on making – well, two things, protecting the quality of the waters that are already clean, and then also – remediating the problems around stormwater and polluted waters that we have from development and other practices. So the everybody's in approach has meant that we have kept every part of the landscape out there, developed or undeveloped, as part of the program. And so far, I think we're doing we've done very well, and I expect everyone to stay – everybody's in. In terms of it being an everybody's in program, the Senate's approach to finance has been everybody contributes. So we are aiming to use a statewide clean water fund assessment that would be assessed on every parcel of land in the state. There are roughly 323,000 parcels, and the amount we've set tentatively, this is going to finance, so we'll see what they have to say. But we put in a $25 per parcel fee, and that raises a little over $8 million. And so that is – I'd say that is our baseline funding. That runs the program sort of broadly. But within that, you know, some people have said there are not every parcel's the same. And what we'd like to do is have some fees that relate to people who have larger exposures and a higher risk of contaminating waters, pollution. And so there are fees that are set very much like the house fees on for agricultural. For instance, large, small – large, medium, and small farm permits or certifications. And then on the Department of Environmental Conservation side, which focuses on stormwater, adjustments to their fees. And the point of those sets of fees is it allows us to put 20 more people out into the field largely in order to have a program that has boots on the ground to do the work that we need to get done.
We talked with several people who have a keen interest in watching what happens with these bills as they move through the legislature and had some thoughts on funding as well. James Ehlers, who's executive director of Lake Champlain International, has a kind of a different model for an everybody in kind of payment scheme. He says, we think the bill needs to include a per person assessment since all Vermonters benefit from our waterways and Vermonters pollute. This would change the culture for all people to pay an assessment through income tax filing, say $2 per week per Vermonter, which raises $65 million, or even $1 per week per person, which raises $30 million. In a state where we celebrate $6 beers, we should value clean water. Not an approach that either of you have taken.
Well, I'd say, you know, we've heard a lot of approaches, and I respect Mr. Ehlers, you know, weighing in on this. Many people have talked to us about how we might raise the money. And one of the things we have to this is in a certain way, you might say it's inside baseball or whatever, but we really need to think about tools to raise the money that are cost effective and practical. And so we have looked at mechanisms we already have in place, and so that if we were to add a fee and try to collect a fee, that we not create a program that is requires hiring yet more people just in order to collect fees and establish an entire new funding mechanism. So you heard Representative Dean mention the property transfer tax. So that's a modification to an existing program. The per parcel fee, we all get a per parcel assessment sent to us already by municipalities, and this will be piggybacking on an existing program. So we're open to all sorts of ideas, but we're also trying to be practical about how we implement them.
We're talking today about Lake Champlain cleanup and clean water in general in Vermont and legislation that's designed to address that that's moving through the legislature right now. We've got a lot of listeners who want to weigh in on this, so we'll double back to some of the money questions perhaps later. But let's also get in some of the questions of our listeners. If you'd like to join them, our number is 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Richard is calling in from Shelburne. Hi, Richard. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm very helpful with the bill that's being discussed in the legislature right now. And David, I know you've been working on this for a long, long time. I've been the past president of our lake association, Lake Carmi, for about 20 years. So I've been working on it for 20 years. But and it's great if we can control the amount of pollution that's coming into the lake. But I'm wondering if there's any consideration being given as to how we can clean up what's already existing. Thank you.
That is part of the discussion, and it is not part of either bill per se, but there is no doubt that down the road it will be necessary for some level of remediation in order to reduce the phosphorus loading in both Lake Champlain and Lake Carmi. The reality is that those remediation steps are, in fact, expensive. They will take a great deal of planning, but there is no point in funding or underwriting those types of efforts until the source of phosphorus loading stops, until the phosphorus loading coming into Lake Carmi, into Lake Champlain, particularly Missisquoi Bay, St. Albans Bay, and the South Lake, until the phosphorus loading stops, taking steps to remediate will not be successful. Once we have things under control, we hit those target levels in terms of what the lake can reasonably absorb for phosphorus, then it's time to go on to take a look at remediation steps. The Clean Water Trust Fund will be able eventually, when it's appropriate and could be effective, will be able to undertake and fund those remediation steps. Its mandate and area of responsibility is broad enough so that those activities could be funded out of the Clean Water Trust Fund.
And I just add to what Representative Dean has said that, I think this bill is really a major milestone in terms of laying out a program addressing water quality in the state. But we should all, I think I want to be very clear about expectations. We're really looking at a program that will go on for the rest of our lifetime and right into our children's lifetimes. There's a lot of work to be done around water quality issues. I'd also just reference an Act 138 report done 2 years ago that said what kind of money would we need to put into cleaning up all waters of the state, including the sort of remediation effort that Richard cited. And the estimate then was $156 million a year for at least 20 years. So that is a staggering figure. And currently, we're in the middle of a tough budget year. We've had this $113 million budget gap to close. And so we are it's a big ask that we're talking about raising new revenues at all, but I think it's a really essential investment for us to make. And the scale of investment that we're making through state monies is on the order of, $8 to $10 million. We also receive federal monies that will actually boost our total effort to closer to $25 million, but right, still a long way from 156.
Yeah, certainly is. And lots more questions, lots more work to do. We have a lot of listeners still wanting to weigh in on this, so we're going to continue the conversation talking about Lake Champlain cleanup, talking about water cleanup and pollution, how to curb pollution that's going into our waterways. We want to hear from you if you work in these fields, if you're working maybe in sustainable agriculture, if you're working on environmental issues, water quality, conventional farming. Give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're chatting with two of the sponsors of legislation aimed at cleaning up Lake Champlain and preventing further pollution from entering Vermont's waterways. Representative David Dean is chair of the House Committee on Fish, Wildlife, and Water Resources, and Senator Chris Bray is chair of the Senate Natural Resources and Energy Committee. Listeners, if you want to chime in, if you have ideas or questions about the bills that are moving through the legislature that would address water cleanup, call 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. James is calling in from Middlebury. Hi, James. Go ahead.
With respect for my friends, Senator Bray and Representative Dean, H-35 and S-49 place no material constraints upon conventional dairy, which is the proximate cause of 50% of the problem. Everyone agrees on that. The bill, for example, does not even mention the word phosphorus, does not mention nitrogen, does not mention the 40,000 tons of NPK fertilizer that conventional dairy imports into the state every year, or the 200,000 tons of high phosphorus grain supplements that the industry brings into the state every year. It doesn't really matter whether the state raises 8 million, 10 million, 50 million, or 60 million. While these things do not appear in the bill, you will not fix the problem.
James, thanks for the call. David Dean, what do you think?
We have had this discussion, and I do not hold myself forth as any kind of expert relative to the agriculture model that we are practicing under and what its future is or should be and whether or not it is the best way to go at this. What the bill does in a comprehensive way is we don't care what land use practices are going on. You will not discharge into the waters of the state. If that helps people make a decision to begin to practice another form of agriculture or to practice another form of land use development, so be it. The economy is going to determine those outcomes. I don't think we can do that by regulation or whatever. What we can do is say that you will not pollute the waters of the state and that you will not add nutrients, which is what the caller is talking about, the phosphorus and nitrogen. And if there is some other way you can practice your craft, trade, or profession, so be it. But that's not our interest. Our interest is the waters of the state. And I don't mean to dismiss the comment at all, but that is certainly beyond the reach of the legislature to reach out and change the economic model of agriculture or anything else.
Senator Bray, do you agree?
Yes. You know, I think I'd underscore what Representative Dean said. That's very important. The laws don't tolerate a discharge to the waters of the state. So, but that said, we know we can improve our practices out there because otherwise we wouldn't have these problems in various places around the state. And so a nuts and bolts piece of this bill is we have currently we have accepted agricultural practices in law. They are renamed required agricultural practices to call them more clearly what they are. They have never been voluntary. They're rules by which every farm that's in operation must operate, and they cover a variety of practices on the farm. And so those are going to be revised as part of this bill, and we are going to raise the level, the performance level of those in order to protect water quality better.
How? Give the details of that.
Sure. So, for instance, there are farm practices around stacking manure. So where do you stack it and what might happen to it as spring rains come along? And right now it is there are setbacks from streams and rivers that we are increasing those to get further away from water hazards, areas of flooding, for instance, so that you don't end up with a flood coming along and sweeping manure away, which is a problem twice over. One, they're valuable nutrients for the farm to use to grow the next year's crop. But they're also a problem because once they get in the stream, they flow off and they support the growth of things like blue-green algae. So we don't want them for both reasons. And the other thing is in terms of the practices on farms. So right now, the state of Vermont permits only the large and medium farms, and that's roughly 200 farms, the dairy farms, out of the approximately 65 or 7,000 farms that are in the state of Vermont. And so one of the things that I think is going to be a major area of opportunity for improvement is that with this bill, we're asking the – oh, not asking. We're requiring the Agency of Agriculture to create a program where they are out and working with small farms as well in order to do outreach and education around the required agricultural practices so people actually know what the rules are, what the practices are. And so there's a teaching component to it, but there's also a regulating component to it where we say you can't be in violation of these if you and you need to learn how not to be in violation of those required agricultural practices. And those are also a baseline. We also have a whole suite of additional things you might do, like cover cropping and grassy swales and riparian buffers that leave grassy areas between active farm fields and passing streams. Those practices can be prescribed by the Agency of Agriculture on a site-by-site basis. So we are improving our knowledge of what goes out happens in the field, and we're going to be improving our practices on literally thousands of farms throughout the state of Vermont.
While we're talking here about the agricultural practices and what's included in the bill, we got a note from Andrew who says, look, nobody likes a broken record, I know, but a huge step to cleaning up our waterways would be to stop glorifying the dairy sacred cow and to stop subsidizing farmers to remove native vegetation for the purpose of giving Vermonters nice views. It was good when inefficient Vermont sheep farm ranches went out of business 150 years ago. If they hadn't, we'd have no wildlife and no forests today. Habitat destroying and lake polluting dairy shouldn't be protected simply because it seems traditional. And going back again to James Ehlers, he says they left these agricultural practices up in the air, and we're talking 3 years before they hire and train new workers. There are new workers who are funded in this bill to go out and check on the farms to make sure farms are complying. James says, and to pass these new agricultural practices, 3 years. He says they're punting back to the Agency of Agriculture, which thinks it needs to be cost-effective for the farmer. There's no remediation in either bill. Where's the Department of Health and ANR in stepping up drinking water monitoring and testing? The EPA isn't even sure that meeting the TMDL will actually clean up the lake, and the TMDL is the total maximum daily load. One of the things that some people do have a question about in these bills is that it will be the Agency of Agriculture that is monitoring farm compliance with these pollution rules. And some people think that the Agency of Agriculture then is sort of facing a conflict of interest because it's also trying to work with farmers. Why not put this into the Agency of Natural Resources?
One of the That issue has been brought to, I believe, both committees. I did not sit through all of the Senate committee work on this, but it certainly was brought to our committee. And when you look at the old model of what the Ag Agency, Agriculture, Food and Markets Agency, did in previous decades, if you will, I've been around for all of that, and we have hit a place where we haven't been before in terms of the cooperation between agriculture, food and markets, and environmental conservation. We have hit a point where we haven't been before in terms of the attitude of the Agency of Agriculture, Food and Markets in terms of their expectations for compliance within the agricultural community. And most importantly, we have hit a point where we've never been before of a willingness on the part of the agriculture community to pitch in, to become part of the solution. Now, will that be every person who practices agriculture in the state? No. But for leadership within the agriculture community, in my committee's experience, they stepped up to the plate. And I believe that our Ag Food Market Agency is leading or helping lead a change in attitude. And I find that just wonderful. So the old model of claiming that things had to be in environmental conservation in order to see any change in practices or attitude or respect for the waters of the state, that's no longer true in my opinion. And as was mentioned earlier, I've been at this for decades. So we chose in our committee and in the House to not make that transfer to environmental conservation, to leave agriculture, food and markets out there in the lead, and with full expectation that we will get similar performance with that agency as we would with the Agency of Natural Resources.
Let's go to Stuart, who's calling in from Greensboro, and then Senator Bray, I'll make sure to get you back in here.
Sure.
Stuart, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. 2 points. First, I'm wondering what the sense of throwing more regulations out there is when already we have agriculture, food, markets, and ANR not enforcing what's on the books. We had an article recently in 7 Days pointing this out, 2 incidents with AAFM field agent Bethany Creaser disregarding the rules. One up in Craftsbury, fairly serious violation was found. The farmer was ordered cease and desist, stop doing this. When she returned, still happening. As I recall, the verbiage was that she said everything was progressing nicely.
So, Stuart, what would you like to see? You want to see tell me what you want then. If you see that's not being enforced, what do you hope happens?
They're already on the books.
Say that again?
I want to see the enforcement of the laws that are already on the books.
Okay, well, let me put that to Senator Bray. What about that? If we can't get the enforcement right now, how are we going to clean it up in the future?
Sure. Stuart raises, you know, I can't speak of the particulars of the farm operation that was in the story he's referring to. But the, you know, as Representative Dean was saying, the Agency of Agriculture has, I'd say, expressed a genuine and strong interest in being better regulators of farming practice. And I think they actually, in this bill, we give them 2 tools that they asked for. One is personnel. So they will have 5 people out in the world regulating, inspecting, dealing with small farms. Until a year ago, they had 0. So they were focused only on the largest farms, and that's only a total count of something like 180 farms. So a very small subset of all farms in Vermont. So they asked for more personnel in the bill, and that's part of where the money goes to. The other thing is they had a set of enforcement capabilities under law that was diminished compared to what the Agency of Natural Resources, the Department of Environment Conservation, had. So we, in essence, sort of cloned those powers of legal enforcement from the ANR statutes and brought them into the Agency of Agriculture. So they asked for legal tools and the personnel in order to be able to get out in the field and regulate. I've known Secretary Ross for decades, and I know that he is working hard and wants to be out there and do this work. I also wanted to jump back to James Ehlers had a concern about when rulemaking would take place and when we'd see those improved RAPs. In the bill that has passed the Senate, those are done completed by July 1 of 2016, so a little more than a year away. That may seem slower than some people would like, but rulemaking is a long process in part because it involves the opportunity for the public to be part of that rulemaking. And I'm sure Mr. Ehlers will be there, and will be the agency will be welcoming his participation.
I want to just before – we just have a minute left, and I want to make sure we get one more thing in here, which is the question about the Environmental Protection Agency, the federal agency, that it's basically a threat that if the state can't come up with a better Lake Champlain cleanup plan and a better funded plan, the EPA may have to take over. We spoke with Stephen Perkins, who works for the EPA. Vermont is part of his jurisdiction. He says, look, we've been following the bills from a distance since the governor's inaugural address. The principal focus is whether the state will have ample dollars. We are encouraged by what the governor proposed and by H-35, and we're cautiously optimistic. Do you think what you, both of you, have put forward is enough to make sure that the EPA does not need to take control and Vermont retains control over Lake Champlain cleanup?
My response is yes, and partially because H-35, and I believe this is the same in the Senate version of the bill, is targeted to critical source areas. We are asking the agencies, both agencies, ANR and Ag Food and Markets, to go out, assess the waters of the state, pick the sources that are the biggest polluters, and fix them. And that is, the in terms of the amount of money, by targeting, we hope that we will be able to make the targets that are set out under this although we don't know what they are until it comes out, under the upcoming TMDL for Lake Champlain.
That's David Dean. He's Westminster State Representative, sponsor of H-35, and chair of the House Committee on Fish, Wildlife, and Water Resources. We've also been speaking with Chris Bray, state senator from New Haven and chair of the Senate Natural Resources and Energy Committee. He is a co-sponsor of S-49, the Senate bill on water cleanup. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll look at another kind of cleanup, how municipalities and developers can get some assistance remediating hazardous waste sites known as brownfields. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Old paint factories, manufacturing sites, former landfills. These are the kinds of locations that are difficult to redevelop because they're often contaminated by hazardous materials. These properties are called brownfields, and there are an estimated 45,000 of them in the United States. In Vermont, a partnership called the Brownfield Economic Revitalization Alliance, or BERA, is designed to help municipalities and developers navigate the bureaucracy and the financial hurdles to getting a site back into productivity. BERA is currently accepting applications, and yesterday I talked with Trish Coppolino. She works on all the hazardous waste sites in the state, and she explained in more detail what a brownfield actually is.
It's any site where there is a real or perceived contaminant issue at the property that impedes any development. So real could be you know that there's contamination there because previous assessment work has been done, or it's perceived because you think that there might be something there or some other property might be causing it to be impacted.
What kind of contaminants are usually found at these sites?
They range from petroleum contamination to PCB contamination. So there's definitely a wide range of contaminants that we see at these properties.
How many brownfields are there in Vermont that you know of?
We have about 4,000 listed hazardous waste sites in the state that are active or closed. So any one of those sites could be considered a brownfield based on whether or not it's going to be redeveloped or there's a change in ownership.
So it's only really a brownfield if there's a desire to have it be redeveloped?
There's that piece of it. There's also a piece around liability. So there's environmental liability associated with owning a contaminated property in the state of Vermont. So if you own a property, there's joint and several liability on the property, which means even if you didn't cause the contamination, you still have a liability or a responsibility to take care of the contamination that's there. And so the Brownfields program also allows for some liability protections from the state.
Just to be clear, we're not talking about individual homeowners who think, oh, I think I've got lead paint in my soil. You're talking about actual development of sort of community resources, or could an individual apply as well?
Individuals can apply. They can apply as a developer of a property. So not if you're doing a home renovation. That's certainly not something we would be interested in funding. But if someone is, you know, buying a multi-unit apartment building that's old and they need to do asbestos and lead paint abatement, those are eligible costs to apply for cleanup. And we have loans and grants that are available for that assistance.
Okay. So this application program, the ability for developers or municipalities to apply, what are they actually getting if they're accepted into this program?
So we have two programs that are run out of the Brownfields program right now. There's the Brownfields Reuse Environmental Liability Limitation Act, or the acronym that we use is BRELA. And that's really a liability program. So if a developer comes into the program at the end of the process, they get liability protection from the state. And there are a lot of different exemptions that fall under there, such as you have protections from changes in standards, any new findings that might be on the site, contribution protection from past owners. It's transferable to any subsequent property owners. So there are a lot of benefits to that liability program. The second thing we're doing right now is called the Brownfields Economic Revitalization Alliance, and that is a program that is really geared towards those complicated brownfield sites where there's a lot of regulatory layers, there's complex issues, there's financial issues, legal issues, and it's jointly administered between Agency of Natural Resources, Agency of Commerce, and the Agency of Transportation. And the three agencies really work hard together to bring in other partners, such as the federal government, municipalities, regional planning commissions, regional development corporations, to try and solve the issue that plagues the redevelopment.
And so the idea here is that if you're accepted into this program, it helps you streamline all of the bureaucracy that you'd need to go through with all of those different departments and agencies to try to get permissions to rebuild or redevelop?
Something like that. It's certainly geared towards streamlining, but it's also geared towards identifying what the hurdles are on the property and having the right people at the table all the time to try and work around or through those hurdles. And some of the hurdles are perceived issues and some of them are real issues. It's just a great opportunity to have everyone trying to problem solve at the same time to get to the same goal instead of, you know, dealing with one program and then dealing with another program and coming back to the first program. This is a way to try and get everyone together now to make it a priority and take care of that issue.
Do you have specific brownfields in mind for this program that you're hoping will be able to fall under it and come back into use?
Well, there are projects right now that we're working on that are in the BERA program. So 453 Pine Street is one of them.
This is in Burlington?
Correct. And this one was one of the first ones that started in the program, and I think it's moving towards being one of our great successes. So 453 Pine Street is located next to the Maltex building and across from dealer.com. It is also surrounded by the Pine Street Barge Canal Superfund site, and it is an undeveloped piece of land right now. And so that particular project has legal issues, it has contaminant issues, it has hydrogeologic issues and funding issues. And so those are the issues that we tried to tackle during this entire BERA process, and I think we've done a really good job getting to an end point where it would be pretty easy for a developer to walk in and create and develop something there.
Who currently owns that?
Rick Davis.
Okay, so it's owned by a private developer.
Correct.
So for these kinds of projects, it doesn't matter whether it's a municipality or a real estate person or a developer who wants to redevelop the site. Anybody who has a potential site like this can apply?
Definitely. If it's a private developer or a municipality, we want to know that there's municipal support behind the project because we need them as a partner in this project as well. It can't just be the state making the project happen. So we need to know that there's support from everybody.
So why wouldn't I then just think, oh, I've got an easy buck I can make. I'm going to buy this site really cheap because there's contaminants, and then I'm going to get priority funding from the state and apply for this project, and then I'll be a hero and have this great site and everybody else is on the hook for paying for it and helping me to develop it?
Well, we certainly don't guarantee that we're going to pay for everything. We have some money, but not a lot of money, and so we target what we think the most pressing issues are to take care of and help, you know, come to a solution on that those problems. For 453 Pine Street, Rick Davis has also been putting a lot of money into the work that we're doing, so it's certainly not a one-sided funded program.
Do you have any other examples in another part of the state, too? Just thinking about, I mean, if you say there are 4,000 brownfield sites that you know of, that's huge.
It is. We have brownfield sites all over the state. So brownfield sites that are in our BRELA program, the Liability Limitation Program, range from, you know, Brattleboro all the way up to Newport. And we have brownfield sites that are in Topsom, Vermont, former Topsom Plating Facility. We're working on a big project in Montpelier at the car lot. There are a multitude of brownfield projects that we're working on. Some people probably don't even know that they are a brownfield project. I mean, City Place in Barrie and the Enterprise Alley project that the City of Barrie is working on are great examples of brownfield sites. We've done a lot of work in Springfield, Vermont, 100 River Street, or the former Fellows Gear Shaper building.
Hmm.
We have a lot of projects along Clinton Street, like Jones and Lampson and Bryant Grinder are projects that we're working on also.
And Trish, just before I let you go, the difference between a brownfield and a Superfund, I mean, in thinking about it, I was trying to think that, is it right to say all Superfund sites are brownfields, but not all brownfields are Superfund sites?
Well, I guess the distinction is the state definition and the federal definition preclude Superfund sites from being a brownfield.
Ah, so a Superfund is sort of like a federal brownfield.
Kind of. They're, you know, large projects where there's a lot of resources needed to get to an endpoint that is site cleanup. They are, you know, projects that the state has put forward and said they're too big for us to handle, and EPA, we need your assistance in, you know, moving these forward so that there aren't any more releases and, you know, human health and the environment are protected.
Got it. Okay. Well, Trish, thank you very much for speaking with me about it. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.
Trish Coppolino works for the Vermont Department of Environmental Conservation on all of the hazardous waste sites in the state. She talked with us about brownfields, contaminated or potentially contaminated sites that are ripe for redevelopment. The Brownfield Economic Revitalization Alliance is accepting applications now for developers or municipalities interested in remediating a contaminated site. We have information and links at vpr.net. Join us tomorrow on Vermont Edition when we'll look at video gaming. Vermont has a particular foothold in the gaming world, thanks in part to a cutting-edge game design program at Champlain College. We'll talk with local experts about what's new in the world of video gaming and what Vermont can bring to the industry. Join the conversation tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.